then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you woke up, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more door for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew. And the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's March the 13th, 2014. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Where to begin this week? Right. A quick comment or two regarding the ongoing Ukraine thing. Now, over the weekend, I ran a commentary on the Thought Crime blog regarding the situation in Ukraine, including a list of all the relevant parties and whatnot, the flags, the personalities, so forth and so on. It's really a confused mess. Now, it seems that I was wrong, and there are, in fact, a few quote-unquote neo-Nazis in the new Ukrainian government, along with at least one Muslim and at least one Jew. So I imagine their cabinet meetings can get pretty interesting. Of course, as I mentioned last week, the liberal media establishment's definition of what constitutes a neo-Nazi and my definition are pretty different. Now, most of these outfits, like Svoboda, which means freedom in Ukrainian, and the right sector are just extreme Ukrainian nationalists or chauvinists or whatever, and while they are anti-Jewish, they are also extremely anti-Russian, which is perfectly understandable in view of what the Ukraine has gone through over the past century at the hands of the Russians and the communist Jews under the Soviet Union. Now, I'm not blaming or criticizing these guys. Like us, they are what their time and place have made them. Many of them are Banderists, i.e. followers of the great Ukrainian national hero Stepan Bandera, who supported the Third Reich and who fought against Stalin. On June the 30th, 1941, 8 days after the Germans invaded, Bandera proclaimed an independent Ukrainian republic, and then for the next 4 years he fought against the Red Army. His opinion of the Jews was not favorable, shall we say. And it's true that most of these Ukrainian nationalists are also very anti-Jewish and anti-faggot, but they're also anti-Russian, possibly primarily anti-Russian. Like the Golden Dawn, they've been running around Kiev with sticks recently, and most of the people they've been whacking with their sticks appear to be people they overheard speaking Russian on the street. As happened in 1941, at the first sign of trouble, the Jews were the first people to fold their tents and flee into the night. I'll always remember that Lithuanian SS man I spoke with in Chicago, who told me that the alleged massacres of Jews were highly exaggerated because they just didn't catch that many Jews. When they heard the SS was coming, they cleared out. Okay, in the meantime, Vladimir Putin is in the process of scarfing up Crimea and the Russian-speaking half of Ukraine, thus cutting Ukraine off from the Black Sea ports and making the rump part of the country completely reliant on goods that have to be imported overland from Europe or Russia, ditto any exporting they do. This action is being taken by the Crimean local parliament, equivalent to a state legislature here. So, in that sense, it's perfectly legal. Now, the last I heard, Crimea has now proclaimed itself an independent republic, which is what some of these yahoos in Montana and Wyoming and Texas keep threatening to do. As per usual, Europeans have more balls than Americans. In Crimea, they actually did it. And that means that Ukraine is now reduced to a landlocked remnant containing mostly actual, for real, Ukrainians. In other words, the situation has resolved itself into what it more or less should be before politicians started playing with maps and redrawing borders after stuffing themselves with a big lunch and 5 martinis or a bottle of wine, as happened in Versailles. Sounds like a Rhodesia type situation, and one that we do not want to develop in this country when white people go for a homeland. Wherever it is, it has to have a significant coastline. It cannot and must not be a landlocked enclave somewhere in Kansas or Wisconsin or some desert southwestern state. There must be a coastline to give the white homeland direct access to the world and at least some chance of importing and exporting by sea. For all the modern technology these days and for all the crap you see on television and Hollywood movies, it is still almost impossible to impose a 100% effective naval blockade, which was why it was never attempted with South Africa. The Israelis are able to blockade Gaza by sea, true, but that's because Gaza is the size of a postage stamp, and there are only a few dozen miles of coastline, which is another reason to avoid tiny little enclaves. We need a whole country with room to grow into. Anyway, back to the Ukraine. Now, I am not going to go too much further into this until the situation clarifies, but I will give you guys this one warning. I am very concerned that we might be looking at another Golden Dawn disappointment here. It's time for me to ladle out some more of that uncomfortable truth about our character, which gets me in so much trouble and causes the goat dancers to leap and whirl and bleat on the internet so frantically. One of the many pathologies our tiny little subculture displays, and has always displayed, is this longing for a great white paradise, somewhere far, far away, or failing that, a pro-white political movement, again, sufficiently far, far away, so as not to involve us. I get it, believe me. In my day, we actually had two foreign countries, South Africa and Rhodesia, where we could look with longing and admiration and maybe even write a few letters to the editor about. But where we almost never actually even visited, never mind moved our asses and our assets there and made a lifetime commitment to. Although, to be fair, there were a small handful of exceptions. Now, the latest manifestation of this was our wild admiration and hero worship of the Golden Dawn in Greece. Yes, I too saw the YouTube videos of Golden Dawn guys attacking bazaars run by illegal immigrants, and I saw them whacking Africans and Muslims on the head with sticks. Sticks, not clubs, which indicated to me that even then they still weren't willing to go all the way to defend their country against foreign invaders, since they didn't have a permission slip from their lords and masters. And yes, I saw Elias Kassadaris slap that commie bitch around the cabinet meeting, and I have to admit, that was some pretty cool theater. What we didn't seem to notice was that Kassadaris was immediately stripped of his parliamentary immunity and arrested, and so far as I know is still locked up. Just as we politely overlooked the fact that, from what I could see, about half of those Golden Dawn guys, if they were in this country, would have easily passed for Mexicans. And just as we refused to deal with the fact that the bulk of the Greek population is basically mestizo, a European Turkic or Levantine mix, and no, we're not going to go there right now. Now, the point I am making is, once again, we thought we had this wonderful, perfect foreign movement, Hitler reincarnated, and we should all just drop everything and fall down and adore and be all about Golden Dawn, Golden Dawn, Golden Dawn, and do nothing at all here in our own country that might involve personal risk or inconvenience, because Golden Dawn was going to do it all for us and create the great white paradise in Greece of all places. Once again, the white man had found another excuse to sit and do nothing. We're great at that. And then last year, the Greek dictatorship finally clamped down on Golden Dawn and arrested their leaders and charged them with forming a criminal organization, which in the Zionist view is any organization that can get anybody elected to a parliamentary body. And when the time finally came for the rubber to meet the road, when the time finally came for those guys to put down the sticks and pick up the Kalashnikov, all those Greek kids just went back into the tavernas, and they're still sitting there doing nothing but muttering into their ouzo, while their leaders stay in prison. Sorry, guys. No great white paradise in Athens, because Europeans, by and large, still have the same problem that we Americans have. They need a permission slip in order to break brave. Guys, I just want to make sure that we are not heading for the same kind of bitter disappointment in the Ukraine that we have so often experienced down through the years in Rhodesia and South Africa and with the British and French National Fronts, and the now neoconservative BNP, headed by bugger boy Nick Griffin, and the Golden Dawn, and all these other foreigners that we somehow get the idea are going to do what we really want done here, but we don't have the balls to do. We want somebody to descend from the clouds on their flying carpets and whisk us away to the great white paradise without our having to lift a finger or incur one single particle of risk. I'm sorry, guys. Not happening. Now, we know what we have to do. It's called the Northwest Imperative. The first thing we have to do is to bring the better elements of the racially conscious community in this country here to the Pacific Northwest. But I can't do that for you. You have to do it yourselves. Once you get here in sufficient numbers, then who knows? Maybe in my old age I can find a white horse or two and a saber somewhere. But I have to have somebody behind me when I draw that saber and yell charge. There is something that you have to do first. That is to get your asses and your assets here. Speaking of which, a new guy here in the homeland who is what we call an organic migrant has come forward and hooked up with the NF. And he contributed this brief MP3 file, which was made on his phone, which is, frankly, something I hadn't thought of before. He's going to have a word with you guys on migration. I actually haven't met this gentleman yet, and as you can tell from the audio, he hasn't met me either. I should mention that I actually removed this comrade's name and a few other details from the file, some things that might identify him to our hostile neighbors who are eavesdropping over the back fence, and so that's why this recording may sound a little choppy.
And I'm new to the Northwest Movement. I'm one of those organic transplants that Howard refers to. I was transferred up here in 1980, serving in the United States Navy. Liked it and stayed. I'm originally from Michigan and do not miss hearing the jungle drums from Detroit. I currently drive a semi-truck for a refrigerated carrier, and there is plenty of freight to haul in and out of the homeland. So, if that profession is an option for you, feel free. Most of the smaller communities will allow you to park your truck at or near your home. So, as Harold so delicately puts it, get your asses and your assets up here. As far as the weather, Harold did nicely. The Puget Sound region, yes, it can get chilly during the winters. Yes, it rains here. And a little Northwest humor here. Washingtonians don't tan, we rust, but it's not as bad as we tell the Southern California, normally tell the liberals down there when I'm down there. Oh yeah, it rains 370 days a year up here, so like rain don't come, but it's not that bad. You get the occasional windstorm, bringing power outages, prepared for that also. If you have allergies around springtime, you may want to have your meds stocked up, as the Scotch broom and the other pollen can be rather rough. Just ask my wife, because she has allergies. And as far as the housing prices, they're not too bad, as long as you stay away from the big cities like Seattle, Tacoma, and Portland. Of course, you don't want to be near them anyway because of the jungle drums and too many darn liberals and bugger boys and all that. The house next door to me just sold last month for $75,000. A little two-bedroom house on a little piece of land. Not new, but it was nice, well-kept, and affordable. Yeah, I'm waiting to see some of those new out-of-state license plates, like Harold says. So get the U-Haul and pack it up and come on up here. We are waiting to see some new people up here. As far as the gun regulations goes, we have both open carry and concealed carry, and it's about just under $55 for a concealed carry permit up here. It usually takes less than a month for it to show up once you go down to the local law enforcement and get your fingerprints taken and stuff. All the members of my family, wife, daughter, and son, all have our concealed carry permits. It's a lot nicer than other places like California and New York, New Jersey, and Massachusetts. And Washington State permit is good in about 20-some other states. Feel free to, like I say before, get your moving van and pack it up and get up here. Take it easy and hope to see you up here soon, comrades.
By the by, comrade, the name is Harold, not Howard, but don't worry about it. For some reason, people have been calling me Howard since I was 4 years old and I got my first pair of glasses. I guess I must look like a Howard. People who have known me for years still slip up and call me Howard sometimes, so it doesn't bother me. And now here's Gretchen,
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I'm going to talk about Tom Clancy's Without Remorse. Now, this is a departure from what I usually discuss. This was actually a book that I ended up finding. To make a long story short, there was a neighbor who was basically having a yard sale and clearing out some of their old books. And I found this Tom Clancy novel that was set in the Vietnam era. And, of course, this is a novel that deals with this issue of covert methods. The beginning of the book is a very difficult story. The protagonist is a Navy SEAL, and he's apparently recently gotten married, and his wife is pregnant. Tragically, she dies in a horrible car accident, and it was really an accident that was no one's fault. And then while this man by the name of Kelly is his real name, he's still in the throes of grief. He ends up meeting up with this other woman who shows up. She's kind of a hitchhiker. She's kind of a drifter, and apparently she has a drug problem, and she's been involved in a drug ring, a prostitution ring, so she has this very seedy past. But he's able to help her get sober, and then he does something very foolish. He takes her back to the neighborhood where she was involved in this drug ring, and she ends up being murdered. There's all these other plots about how this Navy SEAL is being called away to different assignments, and in the middle of the story, he's called away to Vietnam to try to liberate some American prisoners of war. And it's really a very complicated story, but really the most important about it is that he decides that he's going to go after these drug pushers, and he disguises himself as a common street drunk or homeless individual, and really does a very effective job of this. He forgoes bathing while he's on this reconnaissance mission. He buys special clothes that he bleaches them to make them look very worn. He throws away these clothes and buys new ones every time he goes out on a new tickle, so he tries to conceal all this evidence. He even buys a used car to use on these tickles, and he gets an apartment. He uses an assumed name. So he really does everything he can think of to cover his tracks. Now, another thing that he does, because a few times his gallant and chivalrous attitude gets him into trouble. So what he ends up doing is he very carefully and very thoughtfully enlists the help of an individual who he believes will cover his tracks. And through various forms of subterfuge, that pretty much happens, although at the end he almost gets caught, but he has these connections in high places and he ends up walking. So, in a way, it's a very depressing book because a lot of really bad things happen in it, although it has a happy ending, a rather, in some respects, sad, but still a happy ending. At any rate, Harold is right that you can really study these books and you can find out about how these methods can be used to deflect attention, detract attention. He changes his M.O., he changes his methods, he changes the type of weapon that he uses. He's very stealth. Of course, he has no training. He's able to sneak up on people, he's able to make himself unnoticed, he uses camouflage in some cases, and it's very interesting. When he goes to Vietnam on this mission, he ends up having to abort the central mission, but he ends up finding somebody who's been giving secrets to the Soviets, and that ends up helping to create another mission of liberation for the POWs. It's hardly a quick read because there are just so many twists and turns and so many things happen, but it is excellent in terms of understanding the covert method. Now, of course, you have to understand that in today's world, I think it would be more difficult to be covert because so much is tracked online. And I don't know, the only way to be covert these days, I think, is to live under a bridge. And I don't even think you can have a cell phone these days, because if your battery is in your cell phone, then it may be a tracking device. So I don't know quite how one would pull this off in today's world, or you'd really have to go out and live in the woods, I think. But it is educational in terms of covert methods. And you also can really see the influence on Harold writing. I think it's, in a sense, it's Harold's Von Alt, because it's such a similarity. It's almost as if Harold is joined at the hip with this Tom Clancy. So I hope you enjoyed this review, and have a good evening.
Okay, it's our last show before St. Patrick's Day, which is on Monday, so this week's musical selections will be even more Irish than is usual for me. This is Dick Gahan.
Walking all the day by tall towers where falcons build their nests. Silver winged they fly in all the call of freedom in their breasts. I saw black heads against the sky with twisted rocks and run to the sea. Living on your western shore, saw summer sunsets, asked for more. I stood by your Atlantic sea and sang a song for Ireland. Talking all the day, with true friends who try to make you stay. Telling jokes and news, and singing songs to pass the time away. We watch the Galway salmon run like silver darting, dancing in the sun. Living on your western shore, saw summer sunsets, asked for more. Stood by your Atlantic sea and sang a song for Ireland. Drinking all the day in old pubs where fiddlers love to play. Someone touched the bow, he played a reel which seemed so grand and gay. Stood on Dingle Beach and cast in wild foam. We found the Atlantic bass. Living on your western shore, saw summer sunsets, asked for more. Stood by your Atlantic sea and sang a song for Ireland. Dreaming in the night, I saw land where no one had to fight. But waking in your dawn, I saw you crying in the morning light. While lying where the falcons fly, they twist and turn all in your air blue sky, living on your western shore. Saw summer sunsets, asked for more, stood by your Atlantic sea and sang a song for Ireland.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. This is Andy Donner. Today, I'm giving talk number one of my series on real politics. As a reminder, the lecture material I come up with is intended to help new or politically stagnant white nationalists figure out what they should actually be concerned with, both personally and racially. These talks are going to start off with general theory of concern to white nationalist thought, especially in America. Once I get those topics dealt with, I can swing back around to concrete, tangible interests related to securing the existence of our people and a future for white children. Much of that will be new takes on some talks I've given, which have been said to be a little vague, since, in all honesty, I must admit some of them weren't what they needed to be. But for today, I'm going to focus on the allegiance many white people have, not just to system politics, but to America itself. While this misplaced patriotism is sometimes directed towards place and people, it finds its most common expression in absurd loyalty to America's Constitution. Emphasis on the con. Some of you might not quite get what I mean, but allow me a moment or two to explain what forms this can take, since not all of you will have been exposed to each of them. Oddly enough, this seemingly innocuous political ideology runs the gamut from fully anti-government libertarian to religious to anti-democrat, and all the way to sincere white nationalist. There are even the handful of dedicated leftists who can cite article and section to support their political beliefs. Granted, they're a very small number, and while it's no absolute standard, you ought to suspect there's a problem with a political document, such as the Constitution, when all sides claim it supports them. Specifically, I'm concerned with the religious, Tea Party, and white nationalists claiming it's such a wonderful thing and is to be held sacred for purposes of determining who and who isn't a trustworthy political leader or commentator. Personally, the most annoying aspect of this phenomenon is the people who consider America's founding documents to be scriptural canon as if they were written by God himself. Like I said, not all of you will be familiar with everything said today, but I grew up in the sort of religious setting where Christianity is equated with some sort of incredibly perverse handling of the Bible, which sets up the Constitution as a type of holy writ. Some of you may remember the Bush 2-era presidential campaigns conducted by the Constitution Party. For some reason, there wasn't a whole lot of room for the Constitution since the entire campaign was taken up by attempting to grab as much of the church vote as possible by claiming that the contents of the Constitution were the epitome of Christian civilization. Funny thing, though, a pastor of a church I used to attend actually created a constitution to match what a biblical form of government would look like on paper. It's almost the polar opposite of what we have here in America. It involved a centralized monarch with geographic divisions based on where judges needed to be located. There were no juries and no legislature. In fact, even the king couldn't write new laws. The criminal code was locked in place, and the only thing the king could actively decide was how common resources were managed. The idea that America's Constitution is somehow inspired by God just isn't so. When all is said and done, I don't think I'm going to be chucked into any fiery pits for pointing it out, either. As bad as the religious zealots who think America is some sort of second coming are, today I'm mostly addressing the Tea Party and white nationalist Constitution worshippers among us. Now, if you think the zealotry over the Constitution is only religious in nature, you're in for a bit of a shock. As an example, Rush Limbaugh has recently announced his second book for children about American history. This one is titled Rush Revere and the First Patriots. If nothing about that title strikes you as politically wrong, shame on you. Patriotism isn't something unique to America, and the first time patriotism was displayed wasn't during the American Revolution. Only a Kool-Aid-drinking, America-worshipping fool could come up with that title. But this is the sort of thing American muggle assholes lap up every chance they get. Further, most white nationalism I encounter even today still pretends the Constitution is somehow a shield with which we are able to protect ourselves from Obama and his court Jews. Outside of the Northwest Front, the most coherent complaint against Zog usually boils down to, "Oh no! The government didn't obey the Constitution! Oh, but they just have to obey the Constitution! Let's make them obey the Constitution! We can do that, right? Right?" And no, I'm not exaggerating. At all. It seems as though white nationalists fall back on this approach because they're genuinely trying to avoid embracing the Northwest imperative, which is what made me start off with this exact topic. Let me tell you all a few things about this bright and shining beacon of law, which dumbass, ignorant, quasi-political moths swarm about, in the pitch black of the current era. It's fake. It's illegitimate. It's illegal. And it's a lie. And what's best about it is that the people who gave it to us knew all of this while they busied themselves composing it. This is my main point for this particular lecture. I had to spend a fair amount of time reading big, thick books and looking up historic anecdotes from early America. Most of what I'm about to say isn't found in any textbook or patriotard political presentation, and I wanted to make sure I got the details right. Those of you who would like to go look all this up for yourselves can do so, provided I don't get something wrong such that you run off and try to verify something which really didn't happen. The Constitution is frequently held up as the standard of absolute law, and those who don't seem to be under the sway of its siren song are derided as lawless. Let me enlighten you as to how this actually works. What if I were to tell you the Constitution we have today is actually a mockery and illegal? What if it were really a foolish usurpation of the prior incarnation of inspired and infallible government? Well, that's what it is. Most American high school courses skip right over the Articles of Confederation, which is why the questions I'm asking probably don't make a whole lot of sense to you. Put briefly, there was an existing constitution while our current document was being written. At the time, it was just as much the law of the land as our current constitution is today. And most importantly, it made no provision for being done away with. Anyone trying to replace it is just as much a lawless revolutionary as Barack Obama or any other official who has decided they can ignore the current document in favor of whatever else they would rather do. Our own founding fathers were no less criminal, and anyone claiming otherwise is a damned ignoramus. If that doesn't make sense to you, try imagining what would be said about a group of high-ranking socialites who just up and replaced the current constitution with something they cranked out at their country club, and you'll start to understand what I'm getting at. As interesting as that may be, there's an even more damning bit of history which is never, ever brought up in America. We have our own strange idea that America, because of the glory of its infallible constitutional government, was an inevitable development because of the justice on which it was founded. Sorry, but that's not true either. In 1787, Nathan Gorham, president of the Congress under the old constitution, along with Baron von Steuben, invited Prince Henry of Prussia, brother of Frederick the Great, to come over here and assume the role of de facto hereditary monarch of the new country. Obviously, that didn't work out, and it was to a massive amount of dismay. Further, this sentiment had existed for a long time. In fact, the New York Gazette and Weekly Mercury wrote on April 23, 1770, "God forbid that we should ever be so miserable as to sink into a republic." But sink we did. While there was certainly an anti-monarchical streak in early America, it wasn't at all popular. In fact, there's a very famous anecdote about Benjamin Franklin responding to questions from a woman after he emerged from the ratification of the current Constitution. He was asked, "What do we have, a monarchy or a republic?" His response was, "A republic, madam, if you can keep it." Those responsible for our current form of government wrote their last possible option into law rather than their best first hope. And what's worse is that they were entirely cognizant of this when it was happening. The entire exercise of creating another type of government was to avoid the situation we find ourselves in today. The founders were, above all else, attempting to avoid a democracy, since most people from that time were fully aware of the evil one would entail. Nevertheless, they did not establish the most important aspect of political power and its use in the document they left us. While it is true they attempted to establish a republic by blending elements of all sorts of different governing methodologies, they did not enshrine the reality of inequality, and thereby brought about the horror of allowing a large number of people to make significant choices for all of society, otherwise known as a democracy. Now, it's worth noting that the word republic during the historical period in question was used to mean an idealized form of a democracy, as opposed to a non-monarchical rule in general. Someone might question why, then, we're trying to set up the Northwest American, well, republic. In addition to this, I also recall that the proposed system of graduated franchise has caused more than one person to suggest we're employing democracy. Not so. Understand, this is a simple matter of definition and nothing else. Democracy assumes equality and distributes political power to anyone and everyone. That's not remotely what a proper racist government would do. I understand why someone could be confused by the presence of an electoral system, even one where the best of the best held most of the political say-so. But again, by definition, that's not at all any sort of democracy. The history of European monarchy bears out a similar situation, in principle even if not in scale. In practice, the king was supreme so long as he effectively carried out the will of the other nobles. He wasn't really a king so much as he was the prime oligarch. Further, he had the ability to make more nobles, which created the sort of social mobility spoken about in Mein Kampf. I'm not trying to push a monarchy, but merely to illustrate the purpose a political plurality can serve in a fascist state. Even Hitler pointed out that the people, though not in a democratic sense, should be allowed their choice of leadership. But once they've chosen, that's it. No more. Do you see why the American Constitution, which is so often used to dictate our objectives and define our dreams, is easily one of the most evil political documents we know of? A moment ago, I said that no racist would ever support such a thing. But why, then, is it so frequently brought up as part of white nationalism's main case against the powers that be? Our founders' last and least desirable resort has been somehow reimagined as our ultimate solution. I really wish this would sink in so that everyone in the white nationalist community would firstly stop venerating a piece of paper, secondly, realize system politics is horribly flawed so as not to be used as a strategy, and finally, come to the realization that America itself is one of the sources of our problems. Hail victory, comrades.
Got an email from a guy named Joe, don't know where he's from, which reads as follows. Dear HAC, I'm interested in learning more about white history. Are there any books that you would recommend? Also, I would like to remain anonymous if you mention this message on the podcast, signed Joe. So, accordingly, Joe is not his real name. Well, Joe, as most of the listeners know, I produced a series of 56 articles some years ago, which I periodically send out in email form, say, once every 8 or 10 months, on that very subject. I actually read one of those articles a few weeks ago, the story of the Shangani Patrol in Rhodesia. That collection, which I call the Weird Aryan History Series, covers a lot of ground, from the murder of the princes in the tower to Wrong Way Corrigan the Aviator to the victorious German East Africa campaign in World War I to Horst Wessel, plus a lot of true ghost and horror stories, murders, all kinds of good stuff like that. I've also produced two shorter anthologies, which I call the Jewish History Series and the Gay History Series. Now, in the fifth edition of the Party Manual, the White Book, which some of you should be receiving in the mail soon, there is a recommended reading list which covers such subjects as statecraft and politics, Judaism, the science of race, guerrilla warfare, Aryan history, Aryan fiction, so forth and so on. If you will email me again and request it, I'll send you a copy of the White Book via PDF. Now, as to me personally, I've always been interested in history, white history almost exclusively, since I was a very young child, and I'm not sure why. Most Americans find it boring and incomprehensible. Me, I have never been able to understand how anyone can not be fascinated by the past, especially a past as exciting as that of the white race. Now, I'll say it again, if Shakespeare had it right and all the world's a stage, then white people have all the speaking parts. The other races are just along as extras for the walk-ons and the crowd scenes. I have always had the true historian's yearning to get at what German scholars call wie es wirklich war, how it really was. Someone once said that Americans are a people without a past. I once saw a statistic to the effect that less than 50% of Americans, meaning white Americans, can name all four of their grandparents. I mean, actually name them. Grandpa and Mima don't count. And less than 10% could name more than one great-grandparent. Now, many Americans confuse the Korean War with World War II. Something like 30% of the reporters in the Gulf War did not know that there had been a World War I, although you'd think the designation of World War II might have tipped them off that there was a previous version floating around there somewhere. That's a true story. Now, we as a people have no idea of where we've been, and so it's no wonder that we have no idea where we're going. Okay, my recommendations as to actual books you will find in the White Book, but, of course, it depends on what periods and places you're interested in, especially, which, by the way, might also give you a clue as to your previous lives, possibly in those times and places, but we won't get into that. I, of course, have acquired a working knowledge of all history from a political and racial standpoint, but the eras which I feel the most personal resonance with are the late Middle Ages and early Renaissance period throughout Europe, and also the Victorian and Edwardian era, which I consider to be the height of white culture and civilization. I'm not making any wild supernatural claims here, understand, I'm just telling you guys like it is. When I see something like a Durer woodcut or certain old architecture, it just kind of gives me a little ping. And the same with old Victorian photographs, that kind of thing. When I lived in London and Dublin, it was almost like I could see the cities the way they had once been underneath all the modern steel and glass and concrete and the yammering of the black and the Asian immigrants. I don't know what to tell you. Now, this does not mean that I'm not interested in other times and places and eras. I most certainly am. Ancient Rome and the French Revolution top the list, but probably for political and racial reasons. You need to determine when and where you feel your own resonance, Joe. Now, to finally take a stab at answering your question, you need to have the mindset, the literacy, and the patience to sit down and read big, thick books for content, history books. And if you don't have the spirit of the thing, yeah, I know, they can be deadly dull. I can recommend a couple of big, huge, long volumes that if they don't get you hooked on history, I don't know what will. Now, this may come as a surprise to you, but my favorite historian, purely for readability and enjoyment, is a Jewess, Barbara Tuchman. What can I tell you? Not everything these people produce is worthless or harmful. Just about 98% of it. Tuchman's stuff is the exception. I recommend you start with two of her books, A Distant Mirror, about the 14th century, the century of the Black Death, and The March of Folly, which is kind of the history of human stupidity. For general military history, try The Face of Battle by John Keegan and Goodbye Dolly Gray by Rayne Kruger, which is the story of the Boer War. For the French Revolution, the best I've found is Citizens by Simon Schama. For early Bolshevism, try the three-volume Prophet series by Isaac Deutscher and Three Who Made a Revolution by Bertram D. Wolfe, and yes, that's more Jews. For later Bolshevism, try Stalin in Power by Robert Tucker and The Court of the Red Tsar by Simon Montefiore, and yes, I know, he's a Jew as well. The Great Terror by Robert Conquest is also good. Now, you're going to find the whole field of history overrun with Jews. That's a given. It's one of the literary disciplines that they have to control, especially when it comes to things like communism and Zionism. You just have to learn to accept that part of the world as it is, like we have to learn to accept so much else, read between the lines, and just gloss over all the crap. After 40 years, I've got that down to a fine art. Now, for Italian medieval and Renaissance history, try The Lords of Italy and Princes of the Renaissance by Orville Prescott. For medieval England, try The Magnificent Century and The Last Plantagenets by Thomas B. Costain. Now, I don't know what more to say, Joe, because I could rabbit on all night about this. Let me know where your interests lie, and I'll try to give you some pointers. Speaking of history, here's a little bit of quiet horror from the history of Ireland. The terrible loss of millions of her young people over the past two centuries who were forced to flee the country or face starvation and misery. Even in the 1980s, the scars were still there in the minds and the memories of the people. You could see them in almost everything. See, in Ireland, for generations, it was just assumed as a fact of life that at least half of your children would leave the country when they were 17 or 18, and you would never see them again. And the collective damage that this has done to their whole national soul is still incalculable to this day, probably one of the reasons why they're so weird. Take what you hear in this depressing song and multiply it by at least 10 million times over the past 180 years.
Kelly, Ireland, 1860, my dear and loving son John. Your good friend, schoolmaster Pat McNamara, so good as to write these words down. Your brothers have all gone to find work in England. The house is so empty and sad. Crop of potatoes is sorely infected, a third to a half of them bad. And your sister Bridget and Patrick O'Donnell are going to be married in June. Your mother says not to work on the railroad, and be sure to come on home soon. Kilkelly, Ireland, 1870, my dear and loving son John. Hello to your missus and to your four children, and may they grow healthy and strong. Michael has got in a wee bit of trouble, I suppose that he never will learn. Because of the dampness, there's no turf to speak of, and now we have nothing to burn. Bridget is happy you named a child for her, although she's got six of her own. You say you found work, but you don't say what kind or when you'll be coming home. Kelly, Ireland, 1880, dear Michael and John, my sons. I'm sorry to give you the very sad news that your dear old mother has gone. We buried her down at the church in Kilkelly. Your brothers and Bridget were there. She died very quickly. Remember her in your prayers. And it so good to hear that Michael's returning with money he's sure to buy land. For the crop has been poor and the people are selling at any price that they can. My dear and loving son John, I suppose that I must be close on 80. It's 30 years since you've gone. Because of all of the money you sent me, I'm still living out of my own. Michael has built himself a fine house, and Bridget's daughters are grown. And thank you for sending your family picture. They're lovely young women and men. You say that you might even come for a visit. What joy to see you again. Ireland 1892, my dear brother John, I'm sorry I didn't write sooner to tell you that father passed on. He was living with Bridget, she says he was cheerful and healthy right down to the end. You should have seen him playing with the grandchildren at McNamara, your friend. And we buried him alongside of mother down at Kilkelly churchyard. He was a strong and a feisty old man, considering his life so hard. And it's funny the way he kept talking about you. He called for you at the end. Oh, why don't you think about coming to visit? We'd all love to see you.
I scheduled a grim and serious and deeply philosophical segment for this week's podcast because I figured that by now most of the country would be all thawed out, finally, and whatever it was about the cold weather that's been making you guys so comparatively depressed and apathetic since early February when the cold began would work itself out. But I just read on Matt Drudge that tonight the Midwest and Northeast is scheduled to get hit with yet another blizzard and another couple of feet of snow, so I guess not. I guess you're all just going to sit there shivering and miserable for another couple of weeks. I say again, I don't really get that. You would think that unless you're actually physically without electricity, being shut in the cold and the snow would be an ideal time to sit there with your hot drink and your bowl of nachos and play with your computer. But apparently not. Anyway, I'll have to shorten this long and serious part and make it only mildly thoughtful, since so many of you seem to be just hunkered in bed with the covers pulled over your head. When spring finally does come, and you all get outside and get undepressed, I expect a very visible reaction and revival of interest, okay? Right, here it is. Earlier this week, I kind of got into it with a man who is extremely talented and intelligent and who has demonstrated that he is capable of making a much greater contribution to the cause of the Northwest Republic than he does now. Now, to give him his due, he does occasionally contribute valuable assistance, and I don't mean just donating money. He does have something of a movement track record, not very high profile, but a long enough track record so as to indicate that he's a lifer and he'll most likely stick with it. And that's something I always look for. Now, I'll cut to the chase here. This man is one of the few I know who, in my opinion, could, if he so chose and was willing to make TLC total life commitment, he could, quote-unquote, succeed me. Depending, of course, on how one defines succeeding me, and then, of course, dealing with the question of succeed me to what. He not only has the chops for it, and he has enough tread left on the tire, i.e. he's significantly younger than me, so that he could assume this vital role, but he won't. It's too much trouble. He can't be bothered. Now, secondly, several weeks ago, I also kind of got into it with a second comrade, an even younger man, who also, in my opinion, displays sufficient intelligence, knowledge, creativity, and verve to become, at first, my Martin Bormann type that I so badly need to deputize for me and also to quote-unquote succeed me, if necessary, although all the same disclaimers as before about my so-called succession apply to him as well as the first guy. Same situation. He gets everything I'm telling him. He agrees with it in principle, but he refuses to apply his theoretical agreement to himself, and so he's just going to continue to sit where he is in a multiracial toilet. He's just enjoying himself too much there. Now, the big beef was, of course, their refusal to come home, to make the kind of TLC, total life commitment, that I have the right to demand of them in the name of the 14 words in our racial survival, and yes, I do have that right. I can't make you people do the right thing, but I can make the demand of you that you do it. Their reasons for telling me to piss off were similar. To be blunt, since they are both white men of talent and smarts with skills and an education and a work ethic, they are actually doing reasonably well where they are, and they refuse to abandon the material wealth of America and risk losing what they have in order to come here, merely in order to do the right thing that God and history demand of them. As far as these guys are concerned, when it comes to giving up wealth, pleasure, and possessions, God and history can go suck eggs. I repeat that they understand and agree with the concept in principle for other people. It's just that they themselves have no intention of doing it, and they're totally open and honest with me about that. Like so many of us, they're what the Irish call whiskey priests. They know what's right, they just don't do it. And I feel compelled to repeat, these guys and some others like them I could name are not just the usual movement looky-loos who come in for a few months and then wander away when it gets hard and demanding. They have both been of material and beneficial assistance to the Republic in the past. They both understand that the Northwest Front is the only game in town with a chance in hell to succeed, and so far as I know, neither of them is cheating on me, so to speak, with some little neo-national alliance grouplet that consists of nothing but a blog and a website. Nothing like that. They understand my demand for TLC, total life commitment. They agree that it's necessary. They just won't do it. Now, here is where it gets really delicate. One of the primary reasons that these men both refuse to make TLC and get their asses and their assets out here, where they're supposed to be, is because they cannot give up, how do I put this without lapsing into some really disgusting nigger language? They don't want to give up either female companionship or the possibility of female companionship in the future, in a society where such companionship is almost impossible to obtain without prolific outward display of money, material goods, and possessions, and political and social conformity. Damn, I don't want to use that horrible, obscene, disrespectful nigger word, but... Oh, I know. Let's try the British version. Nookie. They don't want to give up their nookie. Or possibly even more so, their future ability to obtain nookie. Lots and lots of nookie, because they're American white boys and they have the right to that, right? I mean, that's what the TV tells them. Okay, let's talk about nookie. Guys, you and I know that the overwhelming majority of American white women have been reduced to gibbering basket cases and emotional train wrecks by political correctness and by growing up in a completely unnatural society, which makes demands on them that no woman of any race is biologically or spiritually capable of fulfilling unless there's something really radically wrong and damaged in both areas, as I am afraid is all too often the case these days. But let's be totally honest here. It's not just women who have been trashed and poisoned and utterly damaged, often beyond repair, by political correctness and the life that it imposes on us both. Men, especially young white males, have been just as fucked up as women have, if not more so, in their attitudes towards sex and the role sex plays in normal Aryan society. Which is something we've almost completely forgotten what it's like, because only a few elderly people like me ever lived in one. And in my case, normality was already fading away when I was born. Now, at the age of 60, even I have only a few faint childhood memories of the old days and how things really were in the old America, because the rot had already started. Then came 1968, when I got thrown into an integrated high school full of violent niggers, weathermen, and trashed-out stoned hippie-dippies. And from then on, the long, strange trip began, as Jerry Garcia would say. No one who is younger than me, I think, can ever really fully understand what life in a sane society is like, because no one can remember it anymore. Now, we can get old videos like Leave It to Beaver and the Brady Bunch, and to us, they just look like jokes, comedies, satires, and we can't get our minds around the fact that once white families actually did live like that. We're so used to the Simpsons as being the average American family. Damn, I'm starting to run long, so I'll get right to the point here. This is for all you white boys out there who are still young enough to be bothered by this. Now, you have been taught all your lives by the television and Hollywood and this whole crappy Jewish youth and consumer culture that life is one big Animal House frat party, and you have the right to an adolescence that continues until you're 40. You have been taught wrong. Now, you have been taught all your lives, through 1,000 different open and subliminal Jewish indoctrination methods, that everything in your lives should always revolve around sex. One way or the other, that sex is the ultimate be-all and end-all of human experience. You've been taught wrong. Now, you've been taught by this slimy media culture that unless you spend your entire life leaping from bed to bed with different women 4 or 5 times a week, you are a quote-unquote loser. And of course, the one thing American white boys fear more than anything else is to be labeled a loser. You have been taught wrong. A man, a real man, is motivated in life not by sex, but by responsibility and duty. Sex is an innate part of fulfilling that duty through marriage and the creation of a family with white children, yes, but only a part. And yes, there is such a thing as bad or undesirable sex, morally wrong sex, sinful sex if you're religious. It's a natural need, yes, but it is a part of our nature that can and should be subjected to disciplined control by the higher will. White people's ability to do that is one thing that distinguishes us from the black and brown animals that surround us. Okay, running long, so I'll sum this up. The possible lack of opportunity for Nookie is not an acceptable reason for you to fail in your duty to the Northwest American Republic and to the 14 words of David Lane. The Republic and the 14 words are more important than your hankering for Nookie or any other personal concerns you may have. Now let me repeat that. This cause is more important than whatever weird personal mess is going on in your mind. We don't have time for that. Get rid of it. I need white boys who are capable of becoming men and subordinating their egos, their fears, their desires, and their dicks to the common good of their people and the creation of a homeland for all of us, because the homeland and the 14 words are more important than any of those things. I say to you yet again, the time may come when our people can live for their own desires and their own ambitions and their own personal fulfillment. That time is not yet. This time around, it's a business trip. This podcast opens with a song called The Rising of the Moon, which is from the 1798 rebellion in Ireland. One of the heroes of that revolt was a young man named Roger McCorley, a working-class Presbyterian from Northern Ireland, who was hanged by the British in Tunbridge, County Antrim, on February the 28th, 1800. Interestingly, McCorley's great-grandson, also named Roger McCorley, was an officer in the IRA during the 1916-1921 War of Independence. Now, not much is known about the original Roger McCorley's life and deeds, but he is remembered because he left behind him a song, which is one of the most magnificent epitaphs any man ever achieved. This is Schooner Fair.
see the fleet-foot host of men who speed with face as one. From farmstead and from fetcher's cot along the banks of Bann, they come with vengeance in their eyes. Too late are they. As young Roddy McCourty goes to die on the bridge of Toon today, up the narrow street he stepped, smiling proud and young. About the hemp-rope on his neck, the golden ringlets clung. There's never a tear in his blue eyes, though bright and proud are they. As young Roddy McCourty goes to die on the bridge of Toon today. Oh, when he last stepped up that street, his shining pike in hand, around him marched in grim array a stalwart harness band. For Antrim Town, for Antrim Town, he led them to the fray. As young Roddy McCourty goes to die on the bridge of Toon today. Oh, never a one of all your dead, for bravely fell in fray. And he who marches to his fate on the bridge of Toon today. True to the last, true to the last, he treads the upward way. As young Roddy McCourty goes to die on the bridge of Toon today. Farnstead and from Fresher's Cot, along the banks of Don, they come with vengeance in their eyes. Too late are they. As young Roddy McCourty goes to die on the bridge of Toon.